Right then, hello and welcome to Time for American Hit Radio, WHBC 90.3 FM, Garden City, New York. The only show on this station that demands 3 seconds of air silence before we go on.
Does it now?
Well, because my theme song starts with a really faint buzz from the studio.
Well, that's not total silence.
So it's pretty close. Pretty close. Dead air before my show. Love it every single time.
Buzz. It's an amp buzz, right?
Yeah, it's an amp buzz. All right. Well, I'm glad you're all here. We started a new topic a couple of weeks back for our How Music Changed series. Excuse me. Bing Crosby is our new topic. Going into the Wayback Machine. Bing was a challenge for me to pick up because he's a character that I really didn't know very much about. Being born when I was, he was never seen as being the coolest character for my generation. And what's cool about this series is that it's turning that around for me. You get to realize that everybody can be cool in their own time, and Bing certainly was more than cool in his. He might have been, as you know, one of my favorite quotes here was from Artie Shaw, which is, the thing you have to understand about Bing Crosby is that he was the first hip white person born in the United States. It's a great quote. And these series of shows are meant to just, point that out step by step. Now, our first show was dedicated to the very early years of Bing and his rather unusual, entry into the music business, almost casually getting there, and that crazy drive that he had to make to get it, to find himself in California. This last week's show showed how he basically was lucky enough to land a spot with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, and after a very shaky start, where it looked like he was not going to be able to make it in the big city because he didn't get great reactions, eventually all of that turned around. And as we ended last week's show, he with his band, the Rhythm Boys, were something of a sensation. Bing was the main reason why the Rhythm Boys were a sensation, though, because Bing had a very interesting talent, especially for that point in time. This was when a lot of the most singers, the pre-microphone era singers, were belters of the Al Jolson type, who would basically have the strength to fill a room. Bing sang with a much more relaxed tone, didn't really thrust his voice quite as hard as the rest of that. Meanwhile, the other singers, the male singers, tended to be almost effete, if not effeminate, in the way that they were approaching vocals. They would normally come at it with diction that would make it seem as though they had basically just stepped out of the parlor. And Bing was kind of cool because he basically had a way of singing pretty much the same way that he spoke. He avoided style. And what he did seemed almost effortless, maybe even artless. But it wasn't artless at all. The point was that he was basically humanizing music, and he was one of the first people to do that. It was a beautiful thing to suddenly not have to hear the timbre of necessarily an opera singer to convey the song,
right,
but to hear somebody who sounded like an ordinary guy,
right,
singing the song. Here's a great example of that, a track of course, Bing Crosby with the Whiteman Orchestra, and you might hear exactly what I'm talking about. Now, this song is fairly elaborate. You're going to hear this big chorus and everything else. It gives so many opportunities for somebody to oversing and to just show their chops. And listen to the way that Crosby carries himself and how he more or less sounds restrained. I think it's one of its strong points. It's called Make Believe.
Thank you. old make-believe. I love you, only make-believe that you love me. Others find peace of mind in pretending. Couldn't you, couldn't I, couldn't we make-believe our lips are blending in a phantom kiss or two or three. Might as well make believe I love you, or to tell the truth, I do.
As music was in the late 20s, as you could see, the emphasis, of course, being on the orchestra with Bing singing his chorus and doing it brilliantly in a manner, like I said, that seemed almost effortless. Now, I'm going to be reading a lot of text in today's show because I'm taking some really extraordinary information from one book, a source that I think is fabulous, especially for this era of Bing Crosby. As it is, you know, we plan to more or less focus on Bing's years when he was relevant as far as formulating the history of popular music. There's not much use sense, really, in going too much past the war years when things began to change and Bing had been usurped by people like Frank Sinatra, most obviously. But up until that point in time, I think Bing does stand at the forefront of popular music. And the book that best captures that and conveys it really well is this book written by Gary Giddens. It's called Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Dreams, The Early Years, 1903 to 1940. You might know Gary Giddens as one of the talking heads on Ken Burns' jazz series.
Uh-huh.
He was there were so many intelligent
critics. Gets all the best people to comment on his things.
Yeah, that was such an entertaining series. I probably watched that Ken Burns thing 3 times in my lifetime from beginning to end, and I could easily watch it again tonight. It's just so excellent. But Gary Giddens appears often throughout, and he's full of great information, and he's the author of this book. So here are his words. Now, also, please understand I'm reading excerpts, so as I bounce around, it might sound like I'm jumping in thought.
A little incongruous.
Right, that is not Gary, that is me.
Don't blame it on Gary.
Well, now that all of a sudden they're at the top of their game here, things start to change. The good life took its toll on the Rhythm Boys. Whiteman complained that they no longer seemed as dedicated to their work. They stayed out late and looked beat at the early matinees. When the movie went on, they would repair to a nearby speakeasy and sometimes could hardly tear themselves away in time to make the next show.
Whoopsie.
The boys' most grievous sin was their failure to grow the act. Whiteman assigned them roles on recordings, but he expected them to develop new material for concerts and their own record dates.
Keep it fresh.
Right, which, like the bands, were made at Columbia. In Bing's estimation, quote, "I don't think we were too serious about our work. It was just something we liked to do. We enjoyed it and never really made a conscious effort to improve ourselves. Although we looked for new material all the time, it was difficult to get all three of us together at one time for a rehearsal. About the only time we did is when Whiteman had something for us to do with the big band, and then we had to be there or we'd get the old sack." So they're not really working.
They're not very mature.
At being stayers at the table, so to speak. Now, although he sang solo on Whiteman's broadcasts as often as he sang with the trio, neither Bing nor his partners acknowledged the inevitable split that had to come. Whiteman attempted to stifle his ambitions, threatening to fire him if he continued to seek screen tests. Yet, pressure from Everett and established agents was building for him to go out on his own. They all wanted a piece of him. Evett was one of his agents. The young Hollywood crowd was captivated by Bing's casually handsome composure. After the Second World War, an observer suggested that if a celestial visitor arrived at a cocktail party seeking an earthling leader and was directed to a group in which Bing was chatting with Winston Churchill and Douglas MacArthur, it would probably assume that Crosby was the guy in charge. Even in 1929, when he was scrambling after a new career and shying from responsibility, peering at his future through the mist of rot-gut whiskey and generally preferring a life on the fairway, Bing imparted a near-regal nonchalance. His innate propriety deflected the kind of vanity that curdles into narcissism. The distinct warmth that defined his singing and later his acting made him seem cool yet approachable. A young contract player named Sylvia Picker observed, "Truthfully, there wasn't a girl in town who wasn't nuts about Bing Crosby." His working-class man's man insouciance was found no less fascinating by men. He had none of the brilliantined conceit and manicured irony rife in Hollywood. He came across as an extraordinary, ordinary guy. Bing and Al finally found a way to favor their benefactress Mildred Bailey, who's Al's sister. She's the one who was responsible for getting them pretty much started in the business at all.
Yes.
Paul Whiteman made it clear he wasn't hiring anybody, including Hoagie, meaning Hoagie Carmichael. But Bing and Al knew that if they could get Whiteman to hear Mildred, he'd fall under her spell. Millie became friendly with several guys in the band that summer. She took them horseback riding in the Hollywood Hills, cooked up a storm, and served her home brew, which created quite a sensation, as decent beer was hard to find. Bing and Al encouraged her to throw a party for the band and its leader. Whiteman, a prodigious beer drinker, happily accepted the invitation. As Bing recalled, Paul didn't know it at the time, but he was a goner when he walked into the house. Hoagie, Roy Bargy, and pianist arranger Lenny Hayton took turns at Millie's Steinway. Rinker describes what happened next. Finally, Bing turned to Mildred and said, "Hey, Millie, why don't you sing a song?" No one had ever heard her sing, but they all joined in. "Yeah, come on, Millie, let's have a song." At first, Mildred acted reluctant, but I knew it wouldn't last long. She asked Al to accompany her on "What Can I Say, Dear?" after "I Say I'm Sorry," and she sang the hell out of the song. After a brief silence, everyone started to cheer, and Whiteman, who had been in the kitchen, asked who was singing. Bing barked, "That was Millie, Al's sister." Whiteman joked, "Don't tell me that there's one in the family who can sing." He then walked over, kissed her, and asked for an encore. All her past experience, singing in speakeasies and night spots, came out as she sang. Her small, pure voice gave the songs feeling and meaning, and you knew you were hearing a singer who was very special, Al wrote. That night, Paul hired her to sing the popular lament Moanin' Low on Tuesday's Old Gold Show. Weeks later, she was on the train to New York, a contract in her purse.
Good
the first girl singer to tour with an orchestra. A year later, she was the highest salaried performer on Whiteman's payroll. Had to get that in only because she was so important to Bing's career getting started. When Whiteman played the Pavilion Royal, Bing had fallen into the Long Island sound and almost lost his job, if not his life.
Oh, no.
Right around the corner here at home. This time, he had a dire experience of another sort. Bing and his brothers told the story so often that it became family lore, the details mutating in the telling. Apparently, the evening began when Kitty Lang rounded up some Ziegfeld girls for a party, and Bing found his companion less than stimulating. In their 1937 fictionalized biography, Ted and Larry Crosby say he left the table and walked to the bandstand to hear a new song, Singin' in the Rain, and returned to find his date pouting. The gerund has the ring of discernment because Bing could not abide pouting and found emotional neediness as unpleasant as emotional dishonesty. He left for another speakeasy where a Valentine wannabe, padded shoulders, greased hair parted in the middle, recognized him and bought him a drink. Bing joined the stranger's party, embarking on a 48-hour brandy binge.
Hello.
He came to in a strange hotel room and stumbled into the bathroom seconds before the front door was blasted open by machine gun fire.
Yikes.
And his companions were sprayed by bullets, all wounded, but none killed. Bing stayed in the bathroom for what seemed like hours until a cop opened the door and asked him who he was, eliciting an innocent bystander routine that Bing claimed surpassed anything he ever did in the movies. The next day, he learned that he had spent 2 days in the hideout of Machine Gun Jack McGurn,
oh boy,
the dapper Capone killer who had taken parts earlier in the St. Valentine's Day massacre and had slit the throat of the singer Joe E. Lewis.
Oh boy.
However mortified Bing may have been by his behavior, and if the McGurn story was embellished, his predilection for a binge was not. He continued to make professional strides. During the band's weeks in New York, before Universal summoned them back to resume or begin work on King of Jazz, an upcoming film on Whiteman, Whiteman and Columbia refused to record the Rhythm Boys because they had failed to develop any new material. But Bing was still in demand for studio work. He had finally exorcised the demon Valley and was now intent on insulating himself from the word crooner, a term that, due chiefly to Rudy Valley, was almost always used disparagingly, often implying deviance. Boston's Cardinal O'Connell denounced crooning as a force for evil and invited parishioners to share his sensation of revolting disgust at a man whining a degenerate song, which is unworthy of any American man. Pundits followed suit. The Springfield Union, enraged to the point of grammatical chaos, reviled crooning as a gratuitous insult to that intelligent person which rightfully expects a better return for its expensive investment in radio equipment.
Whoa.
Well, after Bing achieved his breakthrough, the word crooner would usually be used descriptively or with admiration. In September, Bing recorded for the first time in 4 months since the high-strung Baby, Oh, Where Can You Be, and gave free rein to his natural tones. His heartiness uplifts Groffé's arrangements of Waiting at the End of the Road, an Irving Berlin song memorably introduced in King Vidor's black musical film Hallelujah. This was pre-Valley Bing. Restored and confident, his effortless swing was the flashpoint for the session, which proved to be Bix's last with Whiteman. Basically, what Gary is saying here, Mr. Giddens is saying, is that Bing had gone through a phase where he felt that he needed to keep up with Rudy Valley, and he had changed his method of singing, and it basically led to a very long dry spell until he finally got back to his style before Rudy Valley had appeared on the scene. Meanwhile, Bix, drinking excessively, was coming apart at the seams and ruined several takes. A few days later, Paul put him on a train for his family home in Davenport, Iowa, hoping he would cure himself. Paul kept him on salary for months until it became clear he would not be coming back to the band. Bix returned to New York, though, and freelanced on several sessions, playing a memorably affecting solo, his last as a leader, and then he died in August 1931, at 28 years old.
Tragedy.
"Every once in a while, he'd wake me up in the middle of the night and make me change beds with him," recalled Bing, who refused to concede that Bing was an alcoholic. Maybe because, like himself, he could go without liquor for days at a time. But Bing was kidding himself, more than 20 years after the fact when he wrote of a man who often started his days with 4 ounces of gin. In the end, it was his lack of sleep and his physical exhaustion which broke his health and killed him. Those were Bing's words. Here is Bing on that last song that he performed with Bix in the background, Waiting at the End of the Road.
Thank you. Louisiana, Louisiana, I've been sad, mighty sad. Louisiana, Louisiana, now I'm glad, boy, I'm glad. The whistle's blowing, the train is going, here I come, here I come. I'm tired of roaming, that's why I'm homing, back to happiness and then some. Louisiana, no place is grander, I declare, I do do declare. No skies are bluer, no friends are truer, anywhere, anywhere. Take me to your heart, give me one more start. I's a little child, just been running wild. Louisiana, Louisiana, my own.
Just one of the classics from this era. It's so fun to hear music from this era, basically, when you put it in the context of its own time. It makes it a lot easier to like. It's almost like you've got to remove it from the contemporary sound of what's happening for you to really begin to understand it and feel as though maybe you were alive in that era and this is really what music was like. Let's get right into another song very quickly. Bing, according to, again, from Gary Giddens' book, Bing is more in his element than again in Marvelous Voice with Whiteman on Lenny Hayton's pert arrangement of If I Had a Talking Picture of You, backed by Eddie Lang and Venuti, the fiddler, violinist. The chemistry between Bing and Eddie is fully realized on After You've Gone, a delightfully cool William Grant Still arrangement with voicings that blend rather than separate the strings and the winds, as well as a climax that includes an Andy Secrest solo in the style of Bix and a Joe Venuti solo in a style all his own,
cool,
complete with sparkling break. Directly after the session, Whiteman returned to Hollywood with the band following a day or so later. This time there was no hoopla, no dispatches from the front, no broadcasts, just a quick jaunt to get the damn movie made. It was taking forever. Let's hear both of those tracks back to back. Just to put things in perspective, imagine a time when you could write a song called If I Had a Talking Picture of You. We'll play that right into After You've Gone.
Talking picture of you, I would run it every time I felt blue. I would sit there in the gloom of my lonely little room and applaud each time you whispered, I love you, love you, on the screen the moment you came in view. We would talk the whole thing over, we do. I would give 10 shows a day and a midnight matinee if I had a talking picture of you. left me crying after you've gone. There's no denying you'll feel blue, you'll feel sad, you'll miss the dearest pal you ever had. There'll come a time, now don't forget it, there'll come a time when you'll regret it. Someday when you grow lonely, your heart will break like mine and you'll want me only after you've gone, after you've gone away.
Back to back there, we've heard If I Had a Talking Picture of You and After You've Gone, both with Paul Whiteman and his orchestra featuring Bing Crosby on the vocal breaks. Now, if you're wondering about putting this into the context of the time, I think this next paragraph is going to tell you pretty much everything you need to know. On October 22nd, ooh, it was my birthday, 1929, a few days before the Whiteman Band regrouped in Hollywood, Charles Mitchell, chairman of the National City Bank, responded to a sense of dread that was enveloping Wall Street with consoling words. I know of nothing fundamentally wrong with the stock market or with the underlying credit structure. On October 23rd, Paramount and Warner's called off their negotiations for a merger that might have completely altered Hollywood history. Not a moment too soon. 24 hours later, Black Thursday, the market imploded as nearly 13 million shares were traded at a loss of $6 billion.
Whoa.
The band arrived in Los Angeles a day later. Like most Americans, the musicians were undistracted by the crash. Few of them were in the market, and no one believed that the panic on Wall Street would be anything more than a brief inconvenience. In days that followed, experts reassured the country that the market had stabilized, but on Tuesday, as Paul resumed broadcasting, the bottom fell out.
Yikes.
Nearly 16.5 million shares were traded at a loss of three times the money circulating the entire nation.
Oh, my goodness.
As the wolf settled in for a lengthy stay, entertainment provided solace and balm. But reduced prices and varied giveaways were not enough to lure people into trading hard-earned pennies for filmed vaudeville. They wanted magic and romance and novelty. Stories with happy endings and a chastened wolf. Whiteman's King of Jazz would turn out to be a mammoth casualty of that demand. A sad irony, because Universal's was the most magical review of an era in which every studio felt obliged to release an oversized vaudeville-style parade of talent. Had King of Jazz been finished on time, it almost certainly would have been a smash hit. Instead, because of the delays that plagued the production, the first film review announced was the last to be released. It would appear just as the excitement surrounding Audible Variety ended. Meanwhile, the Rhythm Boys continued with the band when Whiteman left California to play Canada. Incredibly, though, Paul was barred from entering the country at Vancouver. Orchestra leaders, he learned, were entertainers and, quote, as such, could play from theater stages, but not at dances, unquote. After days of wrangling, the tour detoured for a week to Seattle and Portland before finally heading home to New York. But a contretemps that week permanently poisoned the waters between Paul and Bing. In his memoir, Bing explains that a bootlegger dunned him for money he claimed was due for a quart of day-old popskull. When Bing contested the debt, the bootlegger demanded money from Whiteman, who complained over Bing's objection and then deducted the amount from Bing's salary. That led to an argument, Bing wrote, that ended when Whiteman told him, "When we get to Seattle, we'll part friends, and that'll be the end of it." In later years, Bing's tributes to Whiteman were reserved, if sincere. I'm impressed by how kind he was. When I was younger and more hot-headed, I used to think he should line my pockets with more gold, but I confess he owes me nothing. It's the other way around. They had little more to do with each other beyond a few radio appearances. Whiteman had his own troubles. Old Gold dropped his show, and his record sales evaporated. His celebrity and energy kept him afloat for years, but he never recovered his reign. He abandoned jazz just as he was about to enjoy a sweeping triumph in America's mainstream. An embittered, cynical public demanded new and honest music that spoke directly to its dreams and fears. Few in 1930 could have imagined that the scepter would fall to a 27-year-old rhythm boy. Meanwhile, for years, a story circulated on the Fox lot about an eye-level chink in the exterior of one building's wall. The culprit was peppery Dixie Lee. Whenever she passed, a swain or two would be depended upon to whistle, "I wish I were in Dixie." On one occasion, she picked up a stone and hurled it in the direction of her tormentor with such force as to cause the damage, which naturally came to be known as Dixie's Hole. Dixie was no pushover, but she was a relatively typical product of the era, a shapely, shy, talented, if not especially ambitious teenager for whom show business was as much a lark as a living. In an age of infinite chorus lines employed on the stage, in movies, at nightclubs, not even a depression could quell a demand for attractive young women with educated legs or lilting voices or inviting smiles. Dixie was lovelier than most and more capable. On film, she radiated sauciness in a smart, sad-eyed way. She had a strong, unaccented shopgirl's voice and, like her contemporary Jean Harlow, was fashionably plebeian. Harlow, however, was the tough broad type, whereas Dixie was vulnerable, acerbic but wounded. Dixie was quickly put to work and extensively promoted. "I was a big shot because I was a Broadway star," she said. "Yeah, I'd been on Broadway 7 weeks." She was featured in two 1929 pictures, Fox Movie Time Follies and Why Leave Home, and rushed into five more for release in 1930. In Happy Days, she was given a flamboyant number, Crazy Feet, backed by 32 tap dancers.
Wow.
So when Dixie re-encountered Bing at a party in January 1930, she was several rungs up the ladder, while he was a recently paroled singer who had just been rejected for picture work by the very man who was investing heavily in Dixie. Friends advised Dixie, "If you marry that guy, you'll be supporting him for the rest of your life." Others agreed, including Dixie's father, who considered Bing a, quote, "useless, good-for-nothing type."
Oh, boy.
Unquote. Dixie never forgave those who disparaged her husband. "Everybody's saying they made Bing," she said years later. "The same ones who told me don't marry him. He'll never amount to anything. Bing's sweet to them, but I can't be." That they deeply loved each other, no one doubted. But though the marriage blossomed for the better part of a decade, publicly extolled as a fairy tale romance, the story of Bing and Dixie is not a happy one. In the shorthand of Hollywood mythology, Dixie began drinking to keep up with Bing, then put her foot down and forced him to quit. As a result, his career took off while hers disappeared. As insecure as Bing was confident, Dixie was not ungrateful to escape the limelight, but by then her own drinking had gotten out of hand. Warning signs were apparent long before they tied the knot. Meanwhile, Bing's final solo with Whiteman, recorded shortly before the last tour, was a song written for a Maurice Chevalier film that Bing might have adapted as his slogan, "Living in the sunlight, loving in the moonlight." Here's that tune.
Thank you.
bother you. They never bother me. I think everything's fine. Living in the sunlight, loving in the moonlight, having a wonderful time. Haven't got a lot, I don't need a lot. Coffee's only a dime. Living in the sunlight, loving in the moonlight, having a wonderful time. Just take it from me, I'm just as free as any dove. I do what I like, just when I like, and how I love it. I don't give a hoot, give my cares the boot, all the world is in rhyme. Living in the sunlight, loving in the moonlight, having a wonderful time.
As history changes. And by the way, you're listening to American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM from Garden City, New York. Heidi and I do this every Wednesday and Friday between 5 and 6. And on Fridays, we call it How Music Changed. And as you can see, we're smack dab in the middle of doing a little bit of an extended history on Bing Crosby. This is part 3 in that series. Back to the book then by Gary Giddens called The Pocket Full of Dreams. The Ambassador Hotel, with its private bungalows, intrigued the film crowd from the time it opened on Wilshire Boulevard in 1920. Abe Frank knew that a nightclub on the premises could not miss. Within a year, the main ballroom was transformed into the 1,000-seat Coconut Grove, complete with prop palm trees and fake monkeys grabbing fake coconuts. By 1930, the style was Hollywood Moroccan. The palms and monkeys were set against white stucco arches, and a red carpet extended from the top of a wide stairway in the hotel lobby all the way to the grove. The Depression could not lay a glove on the place. Limousines crowded the interest at night. On July 14th at 10 p.m., pianist and band leader Gus Arnheim featured the Riven Boys in his two-hour broadcast over KNX, a powerful station that covered the Pacific Coast and reached as far inland as Colorado. The next night, he officially introduced them to the audience at the Grove, and they were a sensation. Much of young Hollywood had heard the trio at the Montmartre a year before, but the Grove was more established and posh, well known for its star nights and college nights, and as the venue through 1946 for the Academy Awards ceremony.
Wow.
The Grove merged society, royalty, mobsters, and moviedom, a flush following that adored the Rhythm Boys, who appeared nightly and at Saturday teas. At first, the Grove engagement seemed charmed. Bing spent his days at the golf course and encountered little pressure on the job. He behaved. Movie stars said hello and became friends. For a change, Al did some drinking while Harry continued to nip at his flask, but Bing generally abstained. In those first few months, Bing established himself as a ballad soloist with no help from Barris, whose songwriting efforts finally paid off in tunes discerningly tailored to the Crosby cry. They worked out a schedule with Arnheim. Once a night, between dances, they performed one of their numbers alone on the bandstand. For the rest of the evening, they sang choruses with the band. Al noticed something he had not seen before. When the Rhythm Boys or Bing were singing from the bandstand, all the dancers would practically stand still and watch us, and when the band took over, they would dance again. The more observant gawkers may have realized that they were witnessing something historic, Bing's innovative perfection of a new instrument, the microphone.
Ha-ha.
It was his ultimate ally, perfectly suited to his way with dynamics and nuance and timbre. As he explored gradations in projection, Bing collaborated with the electric current as if he were romancing a woman, He played the mic with a virtuosity that influenced every singer to follow, grounding it as a vehicle of modernism. Overnight, megaphones became a joke as the tradition of vocal shouting receded into an instant prehistory. 2 years earlier, Al Jolson had been at the peak of his popularity. Now, he would be recast as the beloved reminder of old-fashioned show business. With the microphone elaborating the subtleties of his delivery, Bing was reinventing popular music as a personal and consequently erotic medium.
Interesting.
Right? One of Bing's most eminent fans was Duke Ellington, visiting Hollywood to make his feature film in the Amos and Andy vehicle, Check and Double Check. Duke's spot required him to introduce the Calamar and Ruby song Three Little Words, but at rehearsal, it was evident that the three members of his brass section assigned the vocal could not handle it. When another trio fared no better, Ellington told the producer to hire the Rhythm Boys. Given the decree against exhibiting white singers with a black band, never mind that the stars of the movie were white actors in blackface,
right,
the boys were set up behind the backdrop with a separate microphone. The number was filmed and recorded live. As they sang, the three Ellington musicians lip-synced. It was the kind of charade parodied in Singin' in the Rain. Ellington asked the Rhythm Boys to sing on the record, too, and by December, Three Little Words topped every sales chart in the country. During the next decade, Ellington refused to hire a male vocalist until he could find one who sang a la Bing. Here is the Rhythm Boys featuring Bing Crosby with Duke Ellington and his orchestra on Three Little Words. That's something that we're going to be covering soon, and I can't wait to cover the Duke Ellington Orchestra when we do a series of shows on them sometime in our future. Meanwhile, On September 29th, 1930, the words, those three little words that they're talking about, became very important in the lives of Mr. Bing Crosby. One Spokane paper loyally reported, "Bing Crosby weds actress." But another accurately reflected the typical coverage, "Spokane boy weds film star." Bing was thought to be coming up in the world. How far he had to go was implied by the account in the New York Times headline, which was, "Dixie Lee is married." Dixie Lee, film actress, was married today to Murray Crosby, 26 years old, orchestra leader at a simple church ceremony. Most of Dixie's fans got Bing's name right, but were not particularly wowed by her choice of husband. Basil Grillo, who was very enamored of Dixie Lee in those days, remembered, "I was in college and absolutely heartbroken. I couldn't figure out why she would marry a lousy crooner." Grillo would eventually direct Bing Crosby Enterprises, earn the crooner his fortune, and learn that Dixie was a very bright, smart woman with the sharpest tongue anyone could possibly imagine. The Los Angeles Times concluded its report, "There isn't to be any honeymoon trip, as both young people are too busy in their professions at this time to be able to spare time to go away." Dixie later acknowledged that they did not honeymoon because they were strapped for money. Bing made only 11 records with Gus Arnheim, the Coconut Grove pianist, between October 30th and May of 1931. Sorry, I did that earlier. And they pack a wallop. They mark the end of Bing's career as a jazz band vocalist and a redefinition of his style from jazz age emoter to poised soloist. Moreover, they serve as calling cards, bringing him to the attention of three men, Max Sennett, Jack Capp, and William Paley, who helped ignite the Bing Crosby era, a quarter-century stretch during which no other performer rivaled his dominance in popular entertainment. Significantly, only one of the Arnheim sides featured the Rhythm Boys, yet the three best-remembered Bing vehicles are the work of his third partner of the Rhythm Boys trio, Harry Barris. Small wonder that Al Rinker, the other Rhythm Boy, was feeling more dissatisfied with his role in the Rhythm Boys. The trio's last appearance on records was a capable version of Them Their Eyes, a song memorably claimed by Billie Holiday in 1939. The harmonizing is sure, but compared with Bing's solo discs, the net effect is pallid. The sound of the trio could no longer compare with the sound of Bing alone. A scat episode, dominated by the zealous Harry and a breezily swinging final chorus, feel frozen and of a fading era. Still, the record was a hit, a last hurrah, boosted by their frequent radio renditions. It was quickly swamped by the revelation of Bing's new ballad style. If his microphone experience at the Grove cured him of the need to belt out a song, his jazz experience indemnified him from the temptations of anemic crooning. Bing soared beyond the restraints of the Arnheim band, which, though adept at a jumpy rhythm, was too hidebound to really swing. He pitched his vocals as much from the throat as from the diaphragm in an attempt to minutely control shading and breathing. "I Surrender, Dear" renovated Bing's professional stature on several counts. Barris configured the melody after hearing Bing sing a variation of "On Lover, Come Back to Me," and Gordon Clifford wrote the lyric. From the time Bing introduced it, the song was hugely popular at the Grove and on radio. He was often asked to sing it several times in an evening.
Wow.
The recording is startling, calling attention to itself with an unconventional arrangement that defied dancers with its frequent change-ups in tempo and manner. Greer had written a concert-style orchestration of a popular song, and, though the effort superficially resembled Whiteman's more inflated numbers, the result was cogently novel. It begins with an introduction by trombones and strings, essays the verse with 16 bars of foxtrotting strings, followed by jazz trumpet and solo clarinet, and then sets the stage for Bing's entrance with a splendid two-bar ensemble transition. Even his chorus, elaborately supported by the band, has a change-up. He sings the bridge over modified stop-time rhythm. The ensuing instrumental chorus starts with trombone and strings, intimating an Eastern strain, and then leads to muted trumpets and responsive violins, a stop-time clarinet, a bridge that suggests a Polish wedding dance, and a finish that combines rigidly marching trombones and a crescendo from which Bing's voice glides for a brief reprise. Let's play this phenomenal number, I Surrender Dear, and then we'll go out with I Found a $1 Million Baby in a 10-cent store, and we'll see y'all next week, everybody. Thanks. Talk to you then.
We've played the game of stay away, but it costs more than I can pay. Without you, I can't make my way. I surrender, dear. I may seem proud and I may act gay. It's just a pose, I'm not that way. 'Cause deep down in my heart I say, I surrender, dear. Little mean things we were doing must have been part of the game. Lending a spice to the wooing. Oh, but I don't care who's to blame. When stars appear and shadows fall, why then you'll hear my poor heart call to you, my love, my life, my all. I surrender, my life, my all. I surrender, April shower. It was the most convenient dawn. I found a $1 million baby in a 5 and 10 cent store. The rain continued for an hour. I hung around for 3 or 4. Around a $1 million baby in a 5 and 10 cent store. She was selling china, and when she made those eyes, I kept buying china until the crowd got wise. Incidentally, if you should run into a shower, just step inside my cottage door and meet the $1 million baby from the 5 and 10 cent store. Love comes along like a popular song, anytime or anywhere at all. Rain or sunshine, spring or fall. Say, you never know when it may say hello in a very unexpected place. For example, take my case. She was selling china, and when she made those eyes, I kept buying china.